A very happy Diwali to all our listeners.
Hope you're all spending your holidays with your family and friends and your loved ones. And having a lot of sweets and getting, you know, gaining a lot of weight, like me.
I think in this festive season, Castbox has something special for all the podcast lovers out there, right?
Yeah, they're running a contest where you could win a lot of gifts, ranging from phones to, you know, watches, smart watches, and a lot more.
Yeah, so how can you be a part of this?
You just have to download the Castbox app and you'll find a banner. The first banner, just click on it and it'll introduce you to the place where they list out all the things you can win, like Redmi Mi 5 Pro phone and then Mi 3 bands and a lot of other cool stuff. So you'd be asked like 5 questions. If you answer it correctly, you'd enroll yourself, you know, just like that. Ooh. And yeah.
So guys, this contest is open till 11th of November. So please don't waste any time. Go download the app and get into it.
And when you are there, you can actually use our coupon code, which is WRITER, WRITER, to get Castbox Premium, which opens up a lot of premium privileges. So yeah, just go there right now and check it out.
So that's our code WRITER, WRITER. And talking about Diwali, I hope you're all celebrating Diwali with all crackers and stuff and being responsible enough that, as we know, it affects a lot of, you know, domestic animals and elderly and people who are
street
sick,
dogs,
right?
Too.
Street dogs as well. Talking about street dogs and domestic animals, I thought we'll talk about the domestication of animals in this episode.
So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes. Welcome to another episode of Right Rand Geek Show. This is your host Vishnu. With me is Shankar.
And this episode, as Vishnu said, we are going to talk about domestication.
All right, so we have a dog at home, right?
We do? I mean, we have a lot of dogs at home. Don't you think so?
We should ask our mom. She'll be able to give us the right count.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, dogs are called the man's best friend and all that. I mean, there's a real good reason for that. We know how he is, right? They are very selfless and all that. And similarly, there are many other domesticated animals as well. But dogs are kind of different. They are completely selfless. So I was sitting and wondering when did it all start? Like, how did dog become man's best friend? And how did we tame an animal which was a wild animal before? Because we know that dogs are descendants of wolves. And I don't think we would want a wolf in our house right now.
They're cute, man. I don't mind, but as long as they don't kill me.
I don't think they're cute. They're handsome, probably, but they're very, very far away from
Well, I have a question. So, are we like just talking about domestication of dogs or...
No, there are certain principles behind domestication of animals. A dog is one key example that you can take and you, use it as case study. But in our discussion today, we'll be using a different case study, which was a Russian experiment, which was run from the 1950s. And it's still going on. That is going to be the primary focus because that explains the kind of, you know, how taming and then later on domestication happens between man, human being, and any different wild animal.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. So take it away.
Before we get into domestication, right, I want to touch on a subject which is a bit controversial. And it's been a controversy since many years, and we are not the ones who started it. All the credit goes to our esteemed Charles Darwin. Who bought the theory of evolution. I think that theory has the world divided into two, right? There are people who swear by the theory of evolution and there are people who, you know, oppose it to the core. So, mostly because it kind of opposes the religious beliefs of many, many religions. Almost all of them, in fact, right? Because we our belief is that God created the world and stuff like that. And then randomly, you know, all the organisms were created on the earth. Evolution says that sometime 4.5 or 3.5 billion years ago, a bunch of chemicals randomly reassembled themselves and started forming into a molecule which started replicating itself, right? That is what science says. And apparently the conditions on the surface of Earth at that time was very much suitable for life to, you know, start. So, yeah, I'm a science boy, right? I mean, I trust science. But then still...
Science boy.
Ross.
Yes.
Again, so people who watch Friends probably would have got that.
I think we have had, like, in our show, we've had a lot of references to like, that series.
Yeah, so anytime we mention something about Friends, if you have not watched, we would highly recommend that you lose 10 days of your life and complete the entire series. I don't think 10 days might be enough, but it's worth the watch. And if you have watched it, you would probably get all our running gags in the show.
Yeah, so you said that science is what we're going to talk about today when it comes to domestication and all that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, science have also said that Earth is round. I don't get it. It's like pretty...
Yeah, so if you're new to the show, Shankar believes that Earth is flat. And he doesn't believe that Earth is round, so that is why we have this coming up once in a while. Yeah, so for our discussion's sake, let's forget about flat Earth. Let's just discuss about how evolution works and stuff like that. So yeah, so what evolution says is, you know, chemicals started assembling and they started forming life, and it kept on replicating. And we know that every cell contains something called DNA.
Yeah,
can probably go into details of DNA, RNA, and all the other proteins in a separate episode. I don't want this to go into that level of detail. Then this might become like a day-long episode. So, so what evolution states is the theory of evolution basically consists of three parts, to put it more scientifically, right? It says it's possible for the DNA of an organism to occasionally change or mutate. That's what we call as mutation. So, when you say mutation, normally we think about this, you know, science fiction movies where some kind of laser or radiation hits a person and he becomes a monster and stuff like that. Somewhat similar to that, but it's not that dramatic. It's when radiation or any factor, there can be multiple factors which affect a cell. And there are certain small changes that happen in the DNA. And if that changes can survive its environment, right, that becomes a mutation and it continues. Right, so that is what mutation is, and every single species that is formed in this whole world is a result of one such mutation.
Right? Yeah, it does it happen in humans too? Like people living in different parts of the world, is there any kind of difference which has come up? Right, if you look at, you know, people of Africa who are living in Africa and the people in Europe, they are completely different, right? So, is there any, you know, mutation kind of stuff which has happened?
See, these are all results of, I mean, there is a lot of environmental factors, right? If you look at places which are tropical, people have darker skin because they have more melanin and that saves them from the sun. And if you go to more polar region, people have pale skin because there's not much sun there. So, yeah, that's all a result of, you can see that variation in humans as well. But evolution is not a process that happens at a blink of an eye or in a lifetime. It happens over a long period of time, which some people are unable to comprehend. That is why this question's like, I don't see monkeys evolving into human beings in front of my eyes, which are just plain stupid, right? So what they need to understand is, billion years is not a small time, right? It's a long, long, long time. So over the period of time, small mutations, they result in, you know, creation of different species altogether. So that is the first part of theory of evolution, is that it's possible for the DNA to occasionally change and mutate. And the change brought by mutation, this is the second part, the change brought by mutation is either beneficial, harmful, or neutral. I mean, that's a given, okay, right? It can be... Only one of these three. Yeah. So beneficial in the sense, some changes like melanin or fishes growing lungs. It's a beneficial change that happened because they were able to crawl from water into land.
And amphibians came
into they started existence. Losing their gills and stuff like that. So initially it was life was completely underwater. Then it became amphibious life. And then slowly, you know, mammals and other reptiles came into being. So, yeah, so it can be beneficial as well, or harmful or neutral. In the case of harmful changes, probably the species won't survive. So we cannot see a live example of a mutation which, you know, which was harmful.
Yeah, harmful. I think Neanderthals can be an example, right? They had body shapes which was like not suitable for the time when they were living. So because of that, they went extinct, kind of.
Yeah, again, yeah, it can be looked at that way. But we don't know exactly what factors led to their extinction yet. Right?
But if you want to get some insight into it, you can check our episode, which is about Neanderthals, which we did like some time back.
Right. And the third part states that as mutations occur and spread over a long period of time, they cause new species to form, which is what we just discussed.
Oh.
So every single species that we see on the surface of Earth today is a result of a mutation that happened to that first cell, which was formed, you know, like three plus billion years ago. So that's what evolution says. And I know that this is always been a part of the controversy, right? Mostly because it conflicts with the religious beliefs of people, but this is what science says, and you know, kind of there is a lot of proof in support of this theory as well, which we have probably learned in biology classes in our younger days. And if required, we can even have a discussion on this, longer discussion, but this is for the scope of this discussion. I don't want to go deeper into it. Just as an understanding on the part of the mutation of DNA part, I just wanted to mention this as a precursor to the discussion that we're going to have.
So yeah, these three points would be the foundation on which we're going to have the discussion.
Yeah, it's good to keep them in mind, is what I'd say. Genetic change that happens in an animal is a result, it's somewhere connected to evolution and stuff. So it's good to remember these points which I just mentioned. So now coming back to domestication, what exactly is domestication? So domestication happens when a species develops a close relationship with humans, right? Close in the sense they're tame. They like to, you know, like the environment in which humans are staying, and they find it beneficial in some way to their existence, and humans may or may not, right? I say that because there are certain cases like cats are domestic animals, right?
Yeah.
Cats get shelter, food and everything, care and everything from us. Now, depending on what kind of cat you own, you might or might not get anything in return. Some cats have too much attitude, if you've seen. I mean, there is a reason for that also, probably. Because they basically are small tigers or lions inside the house, right?
So they are their own masters.
Exactly. So they have not lost that attitude over the evolution that happened. And in some cases, it's mutually beneficial. If you take the example of livestock, cows and buffaloes and all that, they give us milk and meat in some cases, and we take care of them completely. So they are entirely dependent on human beings for their sustenance of their daily life. So that's what domestication basically means. And taming happens when you capture a wild animal and, you know, try to make it obey your rules. Like you see in lions in circus.
Yeah, right? It's basically the fear.
Yeah, fear is a motivating factor to make them obey to human commands and stuff like that. But domestication is where they literally start living with you. You have mutual benefits. So the way you take care of a cow or a dog is very much different from how you take care of a lion or a elephant in a circus, right? So that's what it is. Again, not all mammals can be domesticated, right? If you have seen, horse is a domesticated animal in many places, right? In most of the cases, because they are used for transportation, and these days they are used for entertainment and all that. Horses mostly originated somewhere in Central Asia and Europe, right? But first human beings came out of Africa, where that exodus happened, which we discussed in our previous episode on Genographic Project and stuff. But the readily available animal there was zebra.
Okay.
Zebra used to roam around in Africa, right? But human beings have never tamed zebra.
Hmm. Why?
That is because they are more aggressive. They are not, very comfortable with being around human beings. If you look at both the animals, they're probably almost the same, except for the stripes and stuff. But horses were more tame, you know, they had more, they were more tame to human beings. So that is why it was, they were able to, you know, domesticate horses.
I have actually wondered why humans did not, you know, try to domesticate
zebra. So apparently there are 148 major terrestrial mammals, of which 14 of them have been domesticated. So you see the difference in number.
Wow.
So just because we catch an animal and we start training it, it doesn't become a domestic animal. So there are certain factors which decide whether animals can be domesticated or not. Based on, there are these characteristics. First of these is they should have an efficient diet. In the sense, you should be able to feed them with cheap and accessible food. Let's say if you buy a lion or a elephant, it will be very difficult for you to keep feeding them on a daily basis, right? Lion requires a huge amount of protein in the form of meat and stuff, so you have to make arrangements for that. On the other hand, dogs, or most cases cats can actually feed on the food that you regularly have in your own house. Whatever human beings eat, cats can also have the same thing. So efficient diet is one of the key factors in deciding whether an animal can be domesticated or not. Second thing is quick growth rate, right? If you take an example of any animal like elephant, it has a long period of maturity and, you know, becoming sexually mature and all those things take a long time. So reproduction into next generation takes, it's a long process.
I think its life expectancy is around like 90 to 120.
Yeah, so it's almost, it would almost probably last a human life to get to see the next generation of animals. So that is not a very acceptable factor. It should have a faster reproductive cycle, which is present in dogs and cats and all the other animals which we see around. Third thing is it should be okay to breed in captivity, right? Some animals are very reluctant to start breeding in any environment which is outside of their comfort zone. With domestic animals, for you to be able to domesticate an animal, breeding within, you know, human surroundings should not be an issue at all.
Okay.
So that is another key factor. And they should be pleasant. In the sense, they should not be always,
moody,
in the attacking mode towards human beings or something like that, and not be dangerous as well. And they should not have a tendency to panic, right? When something goes wrong or when a human being approaches them, they should not be just, you know, going. That is the most dangerous thing with wild animals. You never know how they start reacting to certain situations, right?
Yeah, so we have seen a lot of videos where, you know, people, they tame, try to domesticate tigers and grizzly bears and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so there is a good chance that they might just lose their temper or something and probably do some harm to the person who is with them.
See, ultimately, they are wild animals, right? It's just a chance that they are, you know, they are being good. I'm not saying that they cannot continue that way, but every day is just an extended day, if you ask me, right? We never know. A tiger can just playfully play with someone and it doesn't know, you know, how, or it can just get infuriated if an owner accidentally does something or something like that. Cats and dogs are also, prone to this, but they don't retaliate in a way to kill the human, right? Which we cannot speak of in case of tiger or grizzly bear or something like that. So that is a difference. And another important factor is they should be animals that have a social structure.
Okay.
In the sense, they should have a hierarchy in their society. Like they should obey a alpha male or female or whoever leads the pack. And they continue to do that with human beings. In the case of a dog considers its owner to be the alpha of its pack. For him, you are the alpha dog. So that's how it is. So whoever is in charge, he's the alpha and he starts following them.
It applies, even cattle, cows, you know, sheep and all that. So basically, who you are with, they actually feel that you are also.
So in their eyes, you are one of them and you are the leader of that pack. Which is not the case with zebra and some other animals. They are not hierarchy. They don't obey these kind of rules. they come in groups, but they don't have any kind of social, commitment, like, you know, you should obey that hierarchy and all that kind of things. So that is why it's very difficult to tame them. They have no reason to obey you, right? I mean, they don't see you as an alpha. They don't see you as a person who should be directing them to do things.
Okay, which makes me wonder, like, elephants, they have a proper structure, right? They have an alpha male, yeah, alpha female or whatever, and they follow
them. That is
them,
just one... that is a thing, right? I just mentioned six factors. Elephant, yes, it does follow the social structure. Does it have an efficient diet?
No.
Does it have a very quick growth rate? No. Mm. And is it pleasant? I don't know. It might or might not be. I've heard conflicting, reports on that.
I've heard this funny thing, like they actually find us to be very cute and all that.
Yeah, in eyes of elephant, we are like puppies is what I've heard.
Seriously.
They think we are very cute and all that. I don't know. Yeah, so that's why elephants fall into the other category of non-domesticated. Okay, I mean, you can probably do it, but it might be generations before that happens. Can you guess which was the most oldest domesticated animal? This was before even humans started doing agriculture.
Not dogs. Because you have asked, I think it's not dogs. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, this is called as double crossing. It is dog.
It is.
Because you would never expect me to ask that question if it is dog. So dogs are the most primitive domesticated animals, I think. Roughly 15 to 20,000 years.
So I've heard the story about how the Aboriginal people way back, like in Australia, they used to domesticate dogs. Dogs. And they used to measure the climate based on, how many dogs they had to be with during the night. Mm-hmm. So I've heard that it was like back in, 8,000, 10,000 years back. So, yeah.
Yeah, so dogs are... So now, again, when the theory of evolution was proposed, Darwin had something to talk about domestication as well, where there are certain traits which as animals become more tame, they start showing these traits, and some of them are physical aspects as well. Animals become more tame, and in some cases they start growing floppy ears, more curly tails, and patchy fur and all that. The reason that this happens, and their skull size also reduces a lot, they say that the reason that this happens is for the human, the animal becomes very juvenile. Like, mm-hmm, it starts looking cute or, whatever it is. It becomes less wild. It starts looking less wild, and it starts looking more cute. So if you look at cats and dogs, right, that is the reason that they are cute.
Yeah, that's why whiskey is so, furry and floppy.
And if you look at a wolf, you said wolves are cute, but they're not really cute. They look more ferocious. And
that's why even huskies are still like ferocious, right? They have like...
They're probably somewhere halfway.
Oh, wow. But they're so...
And not just huskies. Yeah. If you look at rabbits, mm-hmm, also have, donkeys and all those things. Even cattle. Mm. Calves look very, cows and calves, buffaloes, they all look domesticated, right? Their ears are drooping and all that. Again, there's a theory behind this called neural crest hypothesis, which says that there are these neural crest cells which form during the embryogenesis, the stage where the embryo starts forming. These are embryonic stem cells that produce various tissue types. So there are some changes that happen in this level, which determines whether what kind of characteristics these animals start having when they are domesticated. And one might think that what would happen if you take a domesticated animal and send them back to wild? Would, after many, many thousand years of generations, would they start growing bigger brains and ears become straight and stuff like that? Usually that doesn't happen. And we have an example of one such case. There is an animal called dingo in Australia. Have you heard of it?
Dingo.
Yeah, dingo is a wild dog. Hmm. So dog, as you said, dogs were tamed like 10,000 years ago in Australia. Hmm. And few of them went into the wild, and they have been staying separately from human beings. They are dogs, but they are wild animals, right? They are not domesticated dogs. So still, they still maintain the characteristics that they had. They have drooping ears, and whatever the dog was at that time, they are still the same. So it seems like it's not a reversible change.
The physical aspects cannot be changed. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, Australia is a very interesting place, right? They have very different kind of flora and fauna because of the isolation that happens. Talking about Australia, we keep talking about Australia as a continent and a country, right? Do you know what is Australian continent? How many countries form Australian continent?
Three.
Namely?
Australia, New Zealand, and... And I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're right about one country. Yes, it has Australia in it. Tasmania, one of the small islands, provinces of Australia, that's also part of the continent. Then it has, it doesn't have New Zealand.
It does. Then.
Yeah, what? Let me get into it. It doesn't have New Zealand. It has a part of, it has an island on top of it called New Guinea.
Oh, which I was has, about to say
Yeah, which
that.
Has both yeah. A part of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. That's a different country altogether. So this forms Australia. Now, you might wonder, what about New Zealand? Which part is it? Is it Asia? It isn't. So, New Zealand is completely a different continent altogether, which has probably still not attained the continent status. It's called Zealandia, which is a submerged continent just adjacent to Australia. 93% of that continent is underwater. New Zealand is the only part that sticks out. And a proposal and studies, a proposal was brought up to make it as a separate continent. I think the study started only in 1995. It's very recent. And sometime in 2017, few of the researchers, they decided that this continent satisfied all the requirements to be called as a continent. So very soon it might be made official. I don't think it's made official yet, but New Zealand is going to be a different continent altogether.
Except that 93% of it is underwater.
Yeah,
wow.
So they say if ocean was not there, it would have been a continent long ago.
But ocean is there. Well, anyway, this is like an interesting find. I don't know like how I never read about it. And one more thing is that I've heard about how, not deserted, like how different New Zealand is in case of, how isolated it is. So, deviating from the topic, mm-hmm. I've heard that a lot of companies, they release their products in New Zealand to mm-hmm. give it a trial run because they can check out if it works or not there, and no one will get to know about it, like if it fails or like
isolated.
If it works out.
I think that nearest, I think Wellington is the capital of New Zealand, right? The nearest city to Wellington, big capital city is probably Canberra. Which is in Australia, which is like 1,500 kilometers away.
Wow. One more thing. Canberra is the capital of Australia. I am pretty sure most of people don't
know
it.
People think it's Sydney or something. And I've heard Canberra is a boring city. People sleep by 6 o'clock
or something. See, they had this thing like they thought like they'd make it either Adelaide or Sydney. Then they're like, there was a huge, discussion about that. They're like, we won't go for both. We'll make it Canberra, it seems.
Awesome decision. So that's what it is. So dingo, which comes out of Australia, is a wild dog, but it still maintains the characteristics.
It's a pretty funny name,
That's pretty much about the changes that happen in domestication, right? We'll come to an experiment which was done starting in the 50s about this, testing out most of the theories that were put forward about domestication and whether it's really possible for a wild animal to be domesticated in a human in the present day. Probably within a time scale where humans can really see the change, right? Hit or miss kind of a situation, because you cannot expect too much of genetic change to happen within a human lifetime, which is very, very, very minuscule considering the length of time that has passed already. So we'll get into that. Just before that, I wanted to mention a little bit about how these animals end up being domesticated, right? So they have certain paths that they follow. First one of them is called commensal pathway. These are animals like dogs and cats who are attracted to human ways of life because of some resources which are available in the human society, right? So if you look at dogs and cats, they can feed on whatever human beings are eating and they get shelter and they get water and whatever it is. We are not specifically, we were never hunting them in the past. Neither were we, you know, getting any kind of, we were not even using them for transportation or anything. So humans have very little benefit out of this relationship, this domestication, which happens, and it's called commensal pathway. The second type is prey pathway, wherein, as you can guess, these are the animals which we used to hunt once, right? And we found it easier to tame them and domesticate them and, you know, kind of get the meat and milk out of them.
Chicken
is
borderline.
Chicken is not actually prey pathway. Chicken is a commensal pathway. Because do you know when people actually started eating chicken as a delicacy? It started only 1,000 years ago in Europe.
Okay.
Before that, chicken was used for other stuff like religious purposes and, you know, cockfighting and all that kind of things. It was a sport. Okay. So chicken also had the same role as dog and cat. They just started liking, you know, finding gain in human, finding things in human society which were useful for them, and they started, you know, being domesticated.
They got attracted to us. Wow.
Exactly. Prey, and in the prey pathway are the things like livestock. Cattle, cows and buffaloes and stuff like that, which early human beings used to hunt in the wild. They found it easier to tame them so that they'll be available anytime. Third type is called directed pathway. These include animals which we mostly use for getting things done, like horses, donkeys. So these were tamed possibly not for their meat, because that those were not hunted. And it's not even that they found some benefit in human beings that they had to come and live with us. So we kind of tame them for our own needs. And these are not exclusive stuff. Like there are animals which can fall into either of the categories, like pigs. Pigs can be prey or it can be commensal or anything, right? Yeah. Because it can either be that they approached human society, or it can be that we went ahead and tamed them and wanted to gain benefit from them. Yeah.
So what is the last one called?
Directed pathway.
So directed pathway is almost like the opposite of the commensal one.
Yeah, because we find benefit in them and we start domesticating
them. Okay. Yeah. Even dogs can come under that, I think, because we get a lot of things done with, you know, guard dogs and all that.
That is, I think that all those things happen later, at a later point, because initially dogs used to accompany human beings for hunting and all those things, and they used to feed on whatever is left. Hmm. So that's how it started. Then we realized that dogs have potential to be used as hunters and, you know, retrievers and whatnot, which would have probably happened in a very recent time. So,
Okay.
So with that, I think I'll get into the experiment which was done, which is very interesting stuff, which was done by a Russian scientist. His name was Dmitry Belyaev.
Yeah, another one to ruin. Yeah.
So he conducted something called the Silver Fox experiment. His belief was that all the domesticated animals have been selected for their tameness alone, right? So when humans started domesticating animals, what they did was they used to select animals which are most tame, which are very close, which are tameable, and they used to selectively start breeding them, right? Let's say you have a group of 10 dogs, you select 5 out of them which are most tame and you start breeding them. Right?
Okay.
So he believed that after few generations, tameness would become one of the major characteristics of that animal. So for that, what he did was, he started this experiment on a silver fox, which is a variant of red fox, which has never been tamed or domesticated in the past.
Okay.
So he started this experiment... he started this experiment in 1958, and for the next 26 years of his life until his death, this was his main work. So what he did was he directed his assistant, her name was Lyudmila Trut, to visit various fur farms in Soviet. So Soviet Union had these farms where, you know, they used to extract fur because it is a very cold country, right? So she went ahead to these kind of farms and she started collecting these foxes from various farms. The main criteria to select them was to see which was the most calm and, you know, more tameable, and which were not getting panicked when they see human beings. And so those categories which we spoke
more
about,
friendly.
Right? Which are the friendly ones. They got some foxes, around 30 male foxes and 100 female foxes. Most of them from Estonia. They had a commercial farm there. And they started breeding them solely for tameness. And there was no other criteria that was looked into. How tame they are. The most tamest foxes started breeding them into generations, right? And they were not trained to be tame.
Okay.
So what they used to do was they selected the most tamest animals. They reach maturity around 7 to 8 months. Okay. And once that is done, they'll have their babies. When the baby, from the month one, as and when the caretaker is feeding the animal, they'll try to pet it. They'll probably try to take it in their arms and stuff like that. And they'll start seeing how they react to this human intervention.
Make the baby comfortable.
Exactly.
In the
so are they returning that feeling? That is what they used to see. And by the time they are 7 or 8 months, they attain their sexual maturity.
Again.
And that time, they used to assign these foxes a tameness score. So there is class 1, class 2, class 3. Class 1 being the most tame. Class 3 being okay, but you know, probably not enjoying human companionship and some kind of that. They used to take these class 1 animals and start breeding them again. So just to make sure that the tameness is the thing that is being bred again and again. And surprisingly, the experiment started showing result by the fourth generation.
That's it.
Yeah. So by fourth generation, the researchers were starting to see the results which they were expecting. Which they probably expected to come at a very later stage, maybe after many, many generations, right?
Okay, so what is the result?
So it went so good that they had to create another class called the elite class, where they were much, much more tamer than the class 1 animals, right? So the change that has, so foxes started behaving very much like dogs, right? They became very tame. They became very close to human beings. They started getting floppy ears, patches on their fur, and their tails started becoming more curly. And by the end of 10th generation, 18% of the entire population was elite group, and which by the end of 20th generation has risen to about 35%.
Wow.
And around in 2009, the population of elite foxes in that breeding center was around 80%.
Wow. So in like some 60 years.
Yeah, 50 years.
Yeah. Wow, that's like, that's the, you know, live example of evolution,
yeah, so,
right?
Nobody expected that you can see this change to happen in a lifetime of a human being. But this is a very, very interesting experiment that was done. And one of the employees in between had taken one of the foxes to their house. And when this assistant, she went to see him at his place, this fox was just walking around like a dog. So she was concerned. She's like, you know, if you just let him go just like that, he might just go away into the wild or something. At that moment, this guy just called its name and it just came running to him.
Wow.
So it had almost become tame like a dog. The way you call a dog's name, it comes running back to you. So that's a great change, right? And until recently, people used to buy these
foxes
to be kept in their houses. They were shipped into United States also through a website until recently. I think they have stopped that now. We don't know. But yeah, people have adopted them as domestic pets.
Even I'd like to have one, man, seriously. But I think this is not the first time, you know, humans have bred species to depending on their tameness, right? Even Labradors were created using,
but though, you know, but see, that is a species of a dog. That's a different variety of a dog. It's not a new species altogether.
Okay.
So dog was already tamed or domesticated maybe like 20,000 years ago. Labrador is just selective breeding for certain characteristics.
Yes, selective,
right?
Breeding. That's
if you look
word.
At let's say pug and all those were selectively bred for their short snout and all those things, and after many, many generations they became what they are right now. There are advantages and disadvantages. Some of the you know that bulldog is one such species where it was selectively bred. And the difficult part about that is a bulldog cannot on itself give birth to its baby.
Yeah.
Because its head is so big, it always needs a cesarean. So bulldog species cannot survive without human beings, right? Because someone has to take care of it when it's giving birth.
There are disadvantages.
So there is no natural way for bulldogs to breed. It will normally die in its childbirth if it's just left to itself, right? So there are other side of these kind of selective breeding and stuff.
Yeah, like I'm just throwing it out there. Like through this silver fox experiment, right? It was a wild animal.
Mm-hmm.
So does this mean that there is a possibility where we can find the tamest, couple of breed of wild animal and, you know, get them to mate and then produce these kind of results?
Right, but again, you have to remember those first six characteristics which I spoke about, right?
But this fox would have, you know, not fox almost checked with all things, right?
See, fox's diet, you can easily take care, right? Growth rate was extremely fast with foxes. Seven months. Sexual maturity and it can start breeding. Ability to breed in captivity, doesn't care, you know, about that. It was fine. Pleasant or not, foxes are much more pleasant than what wolves are.
Okay, yeah,
they are
yeah.
usually, you know, there are times when they come into the society and all that. Hmm. So that point might be okay again. They don't panic as much as any other, species probably. And social structure, they are pack animals. So they tick all the boxes. So I don't think that should have been
that's disappointing.
But you cannot try that with lions and tigers for sure.
I was actually thinking, you know, they should do it with polar bears so that I could get one.
We don't know what might be the result of that.
Yeah, now I
but this is one of the most interesting experiments that I have come across, and which kind of proves that there is something behind all this. There is a science behind all this. That's how, you know, domestication basically works. So whatever animals we are seeing right now have been selected for some specific characteristics in the past and, you know, selectively bred for that and then ended up being what it is right now, like what dogs and cats are. And this one experiment kind of, is a proof. And I think it's still continuing. It's not done yet. There is still that farm where these are bred, and I don't know if you can go and buy one, but after researching, I went online. I saw that there are a few people in America who have these foxes shipped from Russia. Half of them, I think 10 of them are in US right now, and half of them are owned by one couple.
Wow.
So they are very tame. You can leash them and take them for walks and stuff like that, but still, it's not like a dog. The owners say that you don't expect it to be exactly like a dog. Like if you get a dog home, it's not going to poop everywhere and be making a mess and stuff. But these don't have those kind of characteristics. It might just get on your table and poop there or whatever it is. So there is a lot more evolution that has to happen. But it's on its way. It's what it is, right? If you continue this experiment for a longer time, we don't know what might happen. So yeah, the experiment did not create another dog species, but it created a fox which is domesticated and pretty close to what dog is. That's what happened. So that's basically a small, look into how domestication works and how it might have happened in the past with the this experiment as an example or probably a proof. That's pretty much it. And I found this to be very, very interesting stuff to research on.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I'm still thinking about it, you know. I don't have any words, you know. And I'm still thinking about it. So just go back to your pet and have a good time this Diwali. Storio is a first of its kind podcast app that implements the concept of social networking amongst podcasters and podcast listeners. It is a space where you can listen, share, and subscribe to podcasts while connecting with podcasters and fellow listeners to get to know what is brewing in the audio sphere. Storio is available for Apple and Android devices, so just go ahead, download it, and connect with your fellow listeners and podcasters.